30. The darkness was still upon the world. The stars were flooding Kalgash with their diabolical rivers of light when Sephira 89 came stumbling out of the gutted observatory building. But the faint pink glow of dawn was showing on the eastern horizon, the first hopeful sign that the suns might be returning to the heavens. She stood on the observatory lawn, legs far apart, head thrown back, pulling breath deep down into her lungs. Her mind was numb. She had no idea how many hours had passed since the sky had turned dark and the stars had erupted into view like the blast of a million trumpets. All the night long, she had wandered in the corridors of the observatory in a daze, unable to find her way out, struggling with the madmen who swarmed about her on all sides. That she had gone mad, too, was not something she stopped to think about. The only thing on her mind was survival, beating back the hands that clutched at her, parrying the swinging clubs with blows of the club that she herself had snatched up from a fallen man, avoiding the screaming, surging stampedes of maniacs who rumbled arm in arm in groups of six or eight through the hallways, trampling everyone in their way. It seemed to her that there were a million townsfolk loose in the observatory. Wherever she turned, she saw distended faces, bulging eyes, gaping mouths, lolling tongues, fingers crooked into monstrous claws. They were smashing everything. She had no idea where Bine was, or Theramon. She vaguely remembered seeing Athor in the midst of 10 or 20 bellowing hoodlums, his thick mane of white hair rising above them, and then seeing him go down, swept under and out of sight. Beyond that, Sephira remembered nothing very clearly. For the whole duration of the eclipse, she had run back and forth, up one hallway and down the other like a rat caught in a maze. She had never really been familiar with the layout of the observatory, but getting out of the building should not have been that difficult for her, if she had been sane. Now, though, with the stars blazing relentlessly at her out of every window, it was as if an ice pick had been driven through her brain. She could not think. She could not think. She could not think. All she could do was run this way and that, shoving leering, gibbering fools aside, shouldering her way through clotted gangs of ragged strangers, searching desperately and ineffectually and futilely for one of the main exits. And so it went for hour after hour, as though she were caught in a dream that would not end. Now, at last, she was outside. She didn't know how she had gotten there. Suddenly there had been a door in front of her, at the end of a corridor that she was sure she had traversed 1,000 times before. She pushed and it yielded, and a cool blast of fresh air struck her and she staggered through. The city was burning. She saw the flames far away, a bright, furious red stain against the dark background of sky. She heard screams, sobs, wild laughter from all sides. Below her, a little way down the hillside, some men were mindlessly pulling down a tree, tugging at its branches, straining fiercely, ripping its roots loose from the ground by sheer force. She couldn't guess why. Probably neither could they. In the observatory parking lot, other men were tipping cars over. Sephira wondered whether one of those cars might be hers. She couldn't remember. She couldn't remember very much at all. Remembering her name was something of an effort. "Sephira," she said aloud. "Sephira 89. Sephira 89. She liked the sound of that. It was a good name. It had been her mother's name. Or her grandmother's, perhaps. She wasn't really sure. "Sephira 89, she said again. "I am Sephira 89. She tried to remember her address. No, a jumble of meaningless numbers.
"Look at the stars!" a woman screamed, rushing past her. "Look at the stars and die!"
"No," Sephira replied calmly. "Why should I want to die?" But she looked at the stars all the same. She was almost getting used to the sight of them now. They were like very bright lights, very bright, so close together in the sky that they seemed to merge to form a single mass of brilliance, like a kind of shining cloak that had been draped across the heavens. When she looked for more than a second or two at a time, she thought she could make out individual points of light, brighter than those around them, pulsing with a bizarre vigor. But the best that she could manage was to look for 5 or 6 seconds. Then the force of all that pulsating light would overwhelm her, making her scalp tingle and her face turn burning hot. And she would have to lower her head and rub her fingers against the fiery, throbbing, angry place of pain between her eyes. She walked through the parking lot, ignoring the frenzy going on all about her, and emerged on the far side, where a paved road led along a level ridge on the flank of the observatory mount.
From some still-functioning region of her mind came the information that this was the road from the observatory to the main part of the university campus. Up ahead, Sephora could see some of the taller buildings of the university now. Flames were dancing on the roofs of some of them. The bell tower was burning, and the theater and the hall of student records. "You ought to save the tablets," said a voice within her mind that she recognized as her own. "Tablets? What tablets?" "The Thombo tablets." "Oh, yes, of course. She was an archaeologist, wasn't she?" "Yes, yes. And what archaeologists did was dig for ancient things. She had been digging in a place far away, Sedjemat, Beklikon, something like that, and had found tablets, prehistoric texts, ancient things, archaeological things, very important things, in a place called Thombo." "How am I doing?" she asked herself, and the answer came, "You're doing fine." She smiled. She was feeling better moment by moment. It was the pink light of dawn on the horizon that was healing her, she thought. The morning was coming, the sun, Onos entering the sky. As Onos rose, the stars became less bright, less terrifying. They were fading fast. Already those in the east were dimmed by Onos's gathering strength. Even at the opposite end of the sky, where darkness still reigned and the stars thronged like minnows in a pool, some of the intensity was starting to go from their formidable gleam. She could look at the sky for several moments at a stretch now without feeling her head begin to throb painfully, and she was feeling less confused. She remembered clearly now where she lived and where she worked and what she had been doing the evening before. At the observatory, with her friends, the astronomers who had predicted the eclipse. The eclipse. That was what she had been doing, she realized. Waiting for the eclipse. For the darkness. For the stars. Yes, for the flames, Sephora thought. And there they were. Everything had happened right on schedule. The world was burning as it had burned so many times before, set ablaze not by the hand of the gods, nor by the power of the stars, but by ordinary men and women. Star-crazed, cast into a desperate panic that urged them to restore the normal light of day by any means they could find. Despite the chaos all around her, though, she remained calm. Her injured mind, numbed, all but stupefied, was unable to respond fully to the cataclysm that darkness had brought. She walked on and on, down the road into the main quadrangle of the campus, past scenes of horrifying devastation and destruction, and felt no shock, no regret for what had been lost, no fear of the difficult times that must lie ahead. Not enough of her mind was restored yet for such feelings. She was a pure observer, tranquil, detached. The blazing building over there, she knew, was the new university library that she had helped to plan. But the sight of it stirred no emotion in her. She could just as well have been walking through some 2,000-year-old site whose doom was a cut-and-dried matter of historical record. It would never have occurred to her to weep for a 2,000-year-old ruin. It did not occur to her to weep now, as the university went up in flames all around her. She was in the middle of the campus now, retracing familiar paths. Some of the buildings were on fire, some were not. Like a sleepwalker, she turned left past the administration building, right at the gymnasium, left again at mathematics, and zigzagged past geology and anthropology to her own headquarters, the Hall of Archaeology. The front door stood open. She went in. The building seemed almost untouched. Some of the display cases in the lobby were smashed, but not by looters, since all the artifacts appeared still to be there. The elevator door had been wrenched off its hinges. The bulletin board next to the stairs was on the floor. Otherwise, everything apparently was intact. She heard no sounds. The place was empty. Her office was on the second floor. On the way up the stairs, she came upon the body of an old man lying face upward at the first floor landing. "I think I know you," Sephora said. "What's your name?" He didn't answer. "Are you dead? Tell me, yes or no?" His eyes were open, but there was no light in them. Sephora pressed her finger against his cheek. "Mudrin, that's your name? Or was? Well, you were very old anyway." She shrugged and continued upward. The door to her office was unlocked. There was a man inside. He looked familiar, too, but this one was alive, crouching against the file cabinets in a peculiar, huddled way. He was a burly, deep-chested man with powerful forearms and broad, heavy cheekbones. His face was bright with sweat, and his eyes had a feverish gleam.
Safira, you here?
I came to get the tablets, she told him. The tablets are very important. They have to be protected. He rose from his crouch and took a couple of uncertain steps toward her.
The tablets? The tablets are gone, Safira. The apostles stole them, remember?
Gone?
Gone, yes.
Like your mind.
You're out of your mind, aren't you? Your face is blank. There's nobody home behind your eyes. I can see that. You don't even know who I am.
You are Balak, she said, the name coming unbidden to her lips.
So you do remember?
Balak, yes. And Mudrin is on the stairs. Mudrin is dead. Do you know that?
Balak shrugged. I suppose. We'll all be dead in a little while. The whole world's gone crazy out there. But why am I bothering to tell you that? You're crazy, too.
His lips trembled. His hands shook. An odd little giggle burst from him, and he clenched his jaws as though to suppress it.
I've been here all through the darkness. I was working late, and when the lights started to fail... My God, he said. The stars. The stars. I had just one quick look at them, and then I got under the desk and stayed there through the whole thing.
He went to the window.
But Onos is coming up now. The worst must be over. Is everything on fire out there, Severa?
I came for the tablets, she said again.
They're gone.
He spelled the word out for her.
Do you understand me? Gone. Not here. Stolen.
Then I will take the charts that we made, she said. I must protect knowledge.
Absolutely crazy, aren't you? Where were you? The observatory? Not a good view of the stars, did you?
He giggled again and started to cut diagonally across the room, moving closer to her. Safira's face twisted with disgust. She could smell the odor of his sweat now, sharp and harsh and disagreeable. He smelled as if he hadn't bathed in a week. He looked as if he hadn't slept in a month.
Come here, he said as she backed away from him. I won't hurt you.
I want the charts, Balak.
Sure, I'll give you the charts and the photographs and everything. But first, I'm going to give you something else. Come here, Safira.
He reached for her and pulled her toward him. She felt his hands on her breasts and the roughness of his cheek against her face. The smell of him was unbearable. Fury rose in her. How dare he touch her like this? Brusquely, she pushed him away.
Hey, don't do that, Safira. Come on, be nice. For all we know, there's just the two of us in the world. You and me. We'll live in the forest and hunt little animals and gather nuts and berries. Hunters and gatherers, yes. And later on, we'll invent agriculture.
He laughed. His eyes looked yellow in the strange light. His skin seemed yellow, too. Again he reached for her, hungrily, one cupped hand seizing one of her breasts, the other sliding down her back toward the base of her spine. He put his face down against the side of her throat and nuzzled her noisily like some kind of animal. His hips were heaving and thrusting against her in a revolting way. At the same time, he began to force her backward toward the corner of the room. Suddenly, Safira remembered the club that she had picked up somewhere during the night in the observatory building. She was still holding it, loosely dangling in her hand. Swiftly, she brought it upward and rammed the top of it against the point of Balak's chin, hard. His head snapped up and back. His teeth clattered together. He let go of her and lurched a few steps backward. His eyes were wide with surprise and pain. His lip was split where he had bitten into it, and the blood was pouring down on one side.
Hey, you bitch! What did you want to hit me for?
You touched me!
Damn right I touched you, and about time, too!
He rubbed his jaw.
Listen, Safira. Put that stick down and stop looking at me that way. I'm your friend, your ally. The world has turned into a jungle now, and there's just the two of us. We need each other. It isn't safe trying to go it alone now. You can't afford to risk it.
Again, he came toward her, hands upraised, seeking her. She hit him again. This time, she brought the club around and smashed it against the side of his cheek, connecting with bone. There was an audible, sharp sound of impact, and Balak jerked to one side under the force of it. With his head turned halfway away from her, he looked at her in utter astonishment and staggered back. But he was still standing. She hit him a third time above his ear, swinging the club with all her strength in a long arc. As he fell, Sephira clubbed him once more in the same place and felt everything give beneath the blow. His eyes closed and he made a strange, soft sound like an inflated balloon releasing its air and sank down in the corner against the wall, with his head going one way and his shoulders the other. "Don't ever touch me like that again," Sephira said, prodding him with the tip of the club. Balak didn't reply. He didn't move either. Balak ceased to concern her. Now for the tablet, she thought, feeling wonderfully calm. No, the tablets were gone, Balak had said. Stolen. And she remembered now they really were. They had disappeared just before the eclipse. All right, the charts then. All those fine drawings they had made of the Hill of Thombo. The stone walls. The ashes at the foundation lines. Those ancient fires, just like the fire that was ravaging Sorrow City at this very moment. Where were they? Oh, here, in the chart cabinet where they belonged. She reached in, grabbed a sheaf of the parchment-like papers, rolled them, tucked them under her arm. Now she remembered the fallen man, and glanced at him. But Balak still hadn't moved. He didn't look as though he was going to, either. Out the office door, down the stairs, Mudrin remained where he had been before, sprawled out motionless and stiff on the landing. Sephira ran around him and continued to the ground floor. Outside, the morning was well along. Onos was climbing steadily and the stars were pale now against its brightness. The air seemed fresher and cleaner, though the odor of smoke was thick on the breeze. Down by the mathematics building, she saw a band of men smashing windows. They caught sight of her a moment later and shouted to her, raucous, incoherent words. A couple of them began to run toward her. Her breast ached where Balak had squeezed it. She didn't want any more hands touching her now. Turning, Sephira darted behind the archaeology building, pushed her way through the bushes on the far side of the pathway and back, ran diagonally across a lawn, and found herself in front of a blocky gray building that she recognized as Botany. There was a small botanical garden behind it, and an experimental arboretum on the hillside beyond that, at the edge of the forest that encircled the campus. Looking back, Sephira thought she saw the men still pursuing her, though she couldn't be sure. She sprinted past the botany building and easily leaped the low fence around the botanical garden. A man riding a mowing machine waved at her. He wore the olive-drab uniform of the university gardeners, and he was methodically mowing the bushes, cutting a wide swath of destruction back and forth across the center of the garden. He was chuckling to himself as he worked. Sephira went around him. From there it was a short run into the arboretum. Were they still following her? She didn't want to take the time to glance behind her. Just run, run, run. That was the best idea. Her long, powerful legs carried her easily between the rows of neatly planted trees. She moved in steady strides. It felt good, running like this. Running, running. Then she came to a rougher zone of the arboretum, all brambles and thorns, everything tightly interwoven. Unhesitatingly, Sephira plunged into it, knowing no one would go after her there. The branches clawed at her face, ripped at her clothing. As she pushed her way through one dense patch, she lost her grip on the roll of charts and emerged on the far side without them. Let them go, she thought. They don't mean anything anymore anyway. But now she had to rest. Panting, gasping with exhaustion, she vaulted across a little stream at the border of the arboretum and dropped down on a patch of cool green moss. No one had followed her. She was alone. She looked up through the tops of the trees. The golden light of Onos flooded the sky. The stars could no longer be seen. The night was over at last, and the nightmare, too. No, she thought, the nightmare is just beginning. Waves of shock and nausea rolled through her. The strange numbness that afflicted her mind all through the night was beginning to lift. After hours of mental dissociation, she was starting to comprehend the patterns of things again, to put one event and another together, and understand their meaning. She thought of the campus in ruins, and the flames rising above the distant city, the wandering madmen everywhere, the chaos, the devastation. Balak. The ugly grin on his face as he tried to paw her, and the look of amazement on it when she had hit him. "I've killed a man today," Sephira thought in astonishment and dismay. Me? How could I ever have done a thing like that? She began to tremble. The horrifying memory seared her mind. The sound the club had made when she hit him. The way Balik had staggered backward. The other blows. The blood. The twisted angle of his head. The man with whom she had worked for a year and a half, patiently digging out the ruins at Beklemot, falling like a slaughtered beast under her deadly bludgeoning. And her utter calmness as she stood over him afterward. Her satisfaction at having prevented him from annoying her anymore. That was perhaps the ghastliest part of it all. Then Sephira told herself that what she had killed hadn't been Balik, but only a madman inside Balak's body, wild-eyed and drooling as he clawed and fondled her. Nor had she really been Sephira when she wielded that club, but a ghost Sephira, a dream Sephira sleepwalking through the horrors of the dawn. Now, though, sanity was returning. Now the full impact of the night's events was coming home to her. Not just Balik's death. She would not let herself feel guilt for that, but the death of an entire civilization. She heard voices in the distance, back in the direction of the campus. Thick, bestial voices. The voices of those whose minds had been destroyed by the stars and would never again be whole. She searched for her club. Had she lost that, too, in her frenzied flight through the Arboretum? No, here it was. Sephira grasped it and rose to her feet. The forest seemed to beckon to her. She turned and fled into its cool, dark groves, and went on running as long as her strength held out. What else was there to do but go on running, running, running?